From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. I am Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, and it's great to have everybody with us on Tuesday Topics this evening. I'd like to thank Brian Charlson, our producer, and our erstwhile editor-recorder Steve Bauer, who turns chaos into good radio programs. Thank you so much, Steve. We would not be able to do this without you, as we wouldn't be able to do it without the software that George buys from Talking Communities, has been kind enough to make available to us. So, George Buys and Talking Communities, thank you so much for making Tuesday Topics happen. This evening, we're sort of doing a follow-up to the programs that we did over the last 2 weeks on baseball, where we explored some issues relating to baseball and people who are blind, and where last week we concentrated on looking at the accessibility of Major League Baseball games through things like game day audio and XM radio. This evening, though, we're actually going to get a little bit more active and consider a sport that many of you may know about, but some of you may not. That is a sport that is played by people who are blind, and really, for the most part, only by people who are blind or blindfolded. The name of the sport is Beat Baseball, and I'm very fortunate to have with me this evening two representatives of the national organization that governs the sport in the United States. That organization is called the National Beat Baseball Association. And first, let's hear from the immediate past president of that organization, who is no stranger to ACB, has been a member of ACB's board and has been active in ACB for longer than I have, and has made contributions to ACB both nationally and in Texas that are just too many and too numerous to list. And that is Dr. Ed Bradley, one of our more famous chiropractors. There are those who say that he became a chiropractor because he was a beat baseball player, but we'll let him tell us whether that's the case. To begin with, Ed, welcome to the program. And could you, for some of the listeners who may be living in Siberia or something, tell us what beat baseball is and how it's played?
Thank you, Paul. I'll be more than happy to do that. Beat baseball is an adaptive sport for the blind and visually impaired, and it was started in 1975 when a group of blind folks got together after they were given a ball made by the telephone pioneers, and they wrote the rules of beat baseball. They started out by using the same field construction of the foul lines being at a right angle to each other and all this good stuff, and the base is 90 feet down the line from home plate. But several other adaptive rules was put into play. For instance, your pitcher pitches to your team, so the object is not to strike people out. The object is to get the ball hit in play. They also, there's no second base, so when you run to first or third base, and you don't know that until the buzzer comes on after you hit the ball, after you get to the base or the fielder puts you out, you go back to the bench and the next player comes up, that play is over with. You either score or get an out each time you come up to bat. The ball must travel a minimum of 40 feet in between the foul lines to be a fair ball also. And the pitcher stands only 20 feet from the batter. He gives two audible signals to let you know that he's pitching the ball. He says ready ball or ready pitch. And the rest of it is timing between you and your pitcher. And when the ball is struck, one of the bases comes on and you try to run to that base and get there before one of the fielders fields the ball cleanly and holds it off the ground under control. If you touch the base first, you got to run. If he gets it under control first, there's an out. And there are two-sided spotters on some teams, and some teams only have one, to assist the fielders, and they can call a zone in the field where the ball is going into. Now, the players can talk to one another. and they can move all wherever they desire. That one call is just made to help the players get a little bit of a location of the ball. Now the bases have been moved back, though, to 100 feet because teams were becoming better at hitting than in fielding. So they moved the bases back to 100 feet. And the bases are placed 10 feet in foul territory so that the runner runs in foul territory and hopefully there's no collisions between a runner and any fielders. And that's a safety factor that's put on. There's four strikes and one pass ball, and you must miss the fourth strike to be a strikeout. And there's no walks in beat baseball, though. In a six-inning game, three outs per half inning, like other baseball game, and otherwise it's, you know, pretty much like baseball. And it's a very exciting, fast-moving sport. There's six players on a team in a field and at bat at each time, and it has evolved into a very, very highly competitive game.
Excellent. Our other guest this evening is Steve Guerra, who is the current secretary of the National Beat Baseball Association. And Steve, can you add something to Ed's description?
I think Ed, or as we all refer to him in the NBBA as Doc, probably because of his profession, but he described the sport beautifully. I think from my perspective, what I can add to that is, in addition to it being the closest adaptation to baseball that individuals who are low vision or have no vision can play and really get the real taste of what baseball is all about. Having the ability to dive on a field and catch a ball with their bare hands, or if they wear a baseball glove, and hearing that ball smack the leather of the glove, hitting a pitch ball and running without worry, pretty much, to a base at full tilt, the run, pitch, and catch, the run, hit, and catch type of scenario of anyone who plays baseball is really emphasized and put into a great perspective for anyone who's playing the sport. You have enthusiasm, you have high levels of competition and adrenaline flowing on those fields, whether it be a game between the Long Island Bombers and the Bayou City Heat, or the West Coast Dogs and the Kansas All-Stars. You have top-level competitions in every game, whether it be in a round-robin format or whether that be in the bracket championship bracket that continues on throughout the week of the World Series. So it really it symbolizes everything for those individuals, those nearly 300 individuals who participate in the sport, whether it be from a volunteer standpoint or from a perspective that it's a player who's actually participating on the field. It enables everyone to really get the thrill and the appreciation of what the sport really brings.
Excellent. Thank you, Steve. Doc, it's my understanding that the pitcher who is pitching is actually sighted. I think that's correct. And it's also my understanding that you indicate that there are one or two people on the other side who will give people some idea of where the ball was hit. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the spotter position works. What exactly does that guy do? And then I have another question for you as well.
Okay, Paul. Thank you for asking that to clarify the spotter position, because that is a very important person on the field. That person, or those two people, they do two things. Number one is they place the players in the best fielding position that they think will be best for their team, and they make a call. The field is divided into zones, in 1 through 6, and they can only make one call or one number call to assist the players as far as after the ball is hit. When the play is over, then they realign their players back in the position that they want them to be. But that call alerts them to where the ball is headed so that they know whether to move or whether not to move. If the ball is hit, for instance, in the 5 zone, which is down the third baseline, the player in 1 is not going to run all the way across the field to try to field the ball on a normal situation. So it does help the fielders to know where that ball is going. And then, again, they place the players in the defensive place where they want them to be. Hopefully, they're placed in the right place for getting an out.
Now, does the field placement change based on who's hitting? I.e., if you know that that the person who's hitting is not a very strong hitter, are you likely to move to a different position than when facing somebody like, say, Ed Doc Bradley, who's likely to hit home runs at every opportunity?
Yes, Paul. The spotters can move the players between or for each batter, and many times they do that. They shift. If, say, you got a person up there that's a dead pull hitter to left field, they're going to move most of their players over there. Or the same thing as a dead pull hitter on the left side. Or if there's a person up there that's a weak hitter, they're going to bring the front two guys up real close. That's part of the strategy, part of the reason for the spotters to being out there to place those players.
Okay. So now we've got a pretty clear idea. So in the top half of the first inning, Team A is up to bat, and they have three outs to get, but that means that their team could bat all the way around if everybody scored each time that they hit, because a player is only out, as I understand things, if the ball is caught by the fielder prior to his getting to the base. Is there any difference in terms of catching between a ground ball and a fly ball, or are there often even fly balls?
Yes, there are a lot of fly balls in deep baseball. And if you catch a ball, if a fielder catches a ball before it hits the ground as a fly ball or a line drive, there's automatically the side is retired. If there's one out, then you get the next two outs automatically. Or if there's no outs, it's all three outs. There's only been about three or four of those caught that have been documented. But that does happen once in a great while. And yes, but there are a lot of fly balls hit in beat baseball. And there's been a lot of close calls coming and people trying to catch them. And I've had a few line drives hit off of me. I didn't catch none of them before they hit the ground. But I've had some hit off of me and come real close to that.
Well, that's kind of a cool rule. So you can be quite a hero if you manage to catch one out of the air. Now, is there such a thing as a home run, Steve? Maybe you could tell us that. I mean, I know that a run scores if the guy gets to the base before, but if the ball gets beyond all the fielders, is that considered a home run?
The home run rules is kind of neat. Previously, they had the home run line at 180 feet, where if someone hit the ball on a fly, and it crossed or touched that line on a fly, it was an automatic, well, it was a two-run home run. But it gave the individual 30 seconds, and Doc can correct me on this because I'm certainly junior to his experience in the league. It gave the individual 30 seconds to get to the base to get the two runs. The interesting part now is the rule has been changed, and for the 2008 World Series and all regional tournaments, that line now is 170 feet. So if you hit a ball and you have the ability and strength to hit a ball on a fly that hits that line, you can actually hit a two-run home run.
And anything you want to add about the new rule? And maybe tell us a little bit about why the rule was changed to make it a little easier to hit home run.
Well, I think that the main thing was that in the past 5 or 6 years, there's only been one home run hit in the World Series, and they feel like that they wanted to give a little bit added opportunity for a home run to give a little bit more excitement in the game, and that's basically the reason why they brought it in, because the ball itself is quite heavy. It weighs between 15 and 16 ounces, which is almost a pound or a pound, and so it takes a pretty good wallop to get that ball out there that far. So it is quite exciting if you hit that ball that far.
The last known individual who hit a documented home run actually is from the Houston team there, Paul. His name is Daryl Miner. And someone put it, a volunteer put it very, very simply. You have to have a perfect pitch from the pitcher. It has to be perfectly placed over the plate. The batter has to have a perfect or near perfect swing, and the aerodynamics have to be perfect. Of course, on a windy day, you know, I don't know that much wind would be able to. It would have to be almost a hurricane gust that would have to take that ball. But it has to be a perfect situation. And again, the pitcher who pitched that ball, and again, Doc can correct me if I'm wrong, was a pitcher for the Houston team by the name of Fonzie. It's certainly a feat in itself, but it's certainly doable. I mean, there are people in the league who have the capability of doing it, but it's not a consistent thing. Now, with the line being moved in this year, you might see more of it. I mean, then it might just make the sport even more exciting than what it is now.
So, Ed, in a typical six-inning game, what is kind of a common score? I mean, is it sort of 10-9 or 38-37? What's a typical score?
Paul, you're right on. There have been many, many games that were 10-9 and even a little bit lower. But there also have been many games that were 38-39. One year I was in the Houston, in the Texas in our state tournament, and the final score of a game was 65-57. But basically the games now, as a rule, usually run in the teens mostly. Occasionally you get up over 20, but it's about in the teens or around 20. But a very good defensive team, or you get two of them together, sometimes the score is held down below 10, and so it depends on the fields too, of how fast the track it is, if the ground's real hard, or if there's a lot of heavy grass. These things do have a part in movement of the ball, so those all things play into it.
So I would assume that if the grass is heavy, there's a greater likelihood that the defensive team is going to be able to get to the ball and catch it. Whereas if it's fast, it's going to be harder to do. Would that be the way that would work?
Yes, Paul, that does make a great deal of difference, particularly on ground balls. If the ground is hard, and the ball will travel much faster, and it is a lot harder. And plus the fact that on a hard ground, the ball takes funny bounces a lot of times, too. So a good heavy grass, the ball rolls truer and slower.
So, Steve, what is the name of the team for which you play? And how successful have you guys been in the World Series over the past few years? And we're going to get to the World Series in just a minute, by the way.
Well, I think in the company of Doc and Ed Bradley and Dave Smogel, who's listening, I'm sure they will get their chuckles out of this. The Long Island Bombers have had a somewhat successful career in the beat baseball world. First World Series was in 2002. And we finished out eighth, I think, out of 14 teams that were there, or 13 teams. We did not have as successful of a campaign last year as we all would have expected to or wanted to. I think for the most part, relative to the team from Houston and the team from Chicago, which Dave Smoker is part of, the Long Island Bombers, which is the team that I started with a friend of mine, Ted Fass, really is in infant stages in comparison to, you know, teams such as the Kansas team, say the West Coast Dogs, which is another team from California. I think that you're finding more teams on the East Coast that are newer to the sport, especially in taking part in the World Series. The teams from New York, or the Long Island Bombers, the Boston Renegades, and the Pennsylvania Wolfpack are all relatively young in comparison to teams from the Midwest and the South. But the Long Island Bombers, I think, for this year, of course, we've just started practicing. We were crazily practicing on Sunday morning, and it was about 42 degrees with a bit of a wind. But we were out there. We were practicing. Our ears were a bit numb, but we were out there. But we're anticipating a lot of great things. You know, we're having some people return to us that haven't been with us for a while, and we're certainly having delusions of grandeur of by all means winning our own tournament, which is being held on May 31st, and we're having teams from the Boston area, in Pennsylvania Wolfpack, and the Chicago Comets, which is the president's team, and the team that is coming to New York, I believe, because Dave Smoker is now retired from playing, he's going to be coaching it. So it's going to be interesting. We're going to have hopefully we're going to have a successful, healthy tournament. Everyone stays healthy, no major injuries, and knocking on wood. But I think the Long Island Bombers certainly have every intention of putting its heart into every game that it plays in Houston in the World Series, despite the heat that we'll have to deal with. But I think we could probably finish out, we're hoping, in the top eight this year.
Thank you, sir. In the interest of full disclosure, I probably need to let our listeners know that Dave Smoka has indicated that Long Island can't win because Steve is on the team. So I don't know, Steve, if you'd like to respond to that.
I'll let it be. Dave and I have a very close relationship, as I have a wonderful relationship with Doc, and I have a great deal amount of respect for both of them. Unfortunately, as they're getting older in years, sometimes salinity seems to take a hold over their intelligence factor.
Ooh, dangerous stuff, and no beer yet. Ed, there are six players to a side. Does that include the pitcher, or does that not include the pitcher?
The pitcher is not part of the six. There's six batters, six defensive players, but the pitcher, catcher, and spotters are not part of that.
Now, just to be sure I've got it all, the six defenders must also be the six batters. That is, they have to play on both sides of the ball, so to speak.
Well, they can have a designated hitter and a designated fielder, but the other five will have to play both ways, yes.
Okay, so there can actually be up to seven or eight people on a team. I'm kind of lost. If you had a designated hitter and a, yeah, there'd still only be seven. So there can be up to seven people who actually play, plus the pitchers, catchers, and spotters on each team. Is that about right?
Yes, Paul, that is correct. The designated fielder and hitter is not used by everyone, but it is available, and a lot of teams are using it now. But that can be seven players playing at any time, yes.
Of course, there might be some people who would argue that you use a designated hitter to allow old people like me to continue to play. Now, obviously, I don't play, and you should be very glad that I don't. I've tried beat baseball a couple of times, and I've got to tell you that I was absolutely unsuccessful at playing beat baseball. Even off a tee, for the most part, I couldn't hit the darn ball. So I have immense respect for all of you guys who do hit it on a regular basis. Now, granted, I had a very amateur pitcher, but the little kids with whom I was playing, who were 8 and 9 and 10, to whom I was introducing the game, did very well with it, thank you very much. So it does take skill, but is one of the reasons that there are designated hitters to enable older people to continue to play who might be a detriment in the field, but who are still pretty good at hearing the ball and hitting it?
Well, Paul, that is one scenario, but usually it is a scenario that you have a person that is either a very good hitter and not a very good fielder, and then you have on the other side a person who's a good fielder but not a good hitter. The age usually doesn't play a big part into it. It's the skill factors involved that normally makes the difference, or makes the coaches choose to do that. So that's why it was put into play, so that you could have another player involved.
Excellent. Okay, let's for a little while talk about the World Series. I know that it's going to take place in Houston between the 28th of July and the 2nd of August, and Houston is Ed Bradley's home stomping ground, so they will be hosting the Beat Baseball World Series. How many teams are you expecting at this point, Ed, or do you know yet?
At this time, I'm not for sure, but it looks like there'll be 14 or 15 teams coming into the World Series this year, and I certainly hope they all show up. And we will be playing our games at a place called Meyer Park in North Houston, and our host hotel is the Greensport Marriott, which is a short distance from Bush Intercontinental Airport. And we are excited We are working hard, and we have a great deal of the plans already in place, and it looks like we're going to have a very good World Series. And I just hope that we have some nice, warm Houston weather to greet these folks from up north.
Yeah, and the folks from up north would probably say, oh, yeah, sure, just because you guys are used to the heat. But anyway, let me ask you, if I could, to talk a little bit about the teams that are likely to be coming. Is any team who are members, are any teams who are members of the National Beat Baseball Association eligible to come and play in the World Series? By the way, Dave says that they're looking forward to being in Houston, especially given the cold weather they're getting now. And the implication of that is that for Chicagoans who are used to hot summers, Houston ain't nothing. It's okay, Dave. I'll speak for you, man. So, Ed, tell me a little bit, if you would, about how a team qualifies to come, and then we'll get in a little bit to how the format of the World Series works.
The teams, basically, that will be here, we have two teams from California, the West Coast Dogs and the Stockton Stingrays, and we have a team from Denver, Colorado, Austin, Texas, Tyler, Texas, Houston, Texas, Kansas, Indianapolis, Indiana, Chicago, Illinois, Cleveland, Ohio, New York, Boston, somewhere in Pennsylvania. I'm not sure if it's Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, but somewhere in Pennsylvania. And then we're hoping to have a team to come over from Taiwan. These teams that are there, we may have one or two other teams show up, but these are your basic teams, and the competition will be extremely, extremely good. Kansas won the tournament last year with West Coast coming in second, so they're looking forward to a very competitive tournament.
Well, if I can interject, I don't know if I heard all the teams, but the team from Pennsylvania is called the Pennsylvania Wolfpack. They're from Upper Darby or near Philadelphia. Then you have the Long Island Bombers, the Boston Renegades, the Cleveland Scrappers, Indianapolis Thunder, Chicago Comets. Then we swing down south a little bit. Actually, we go into Carolina. We have the Carolina Pride. Then we have the three teams from Texas, Tyler, Texas, the Austin Blackhawks, and the Houston Bayou City Heat, which is 9. You have Kansas. You have the Colorado Storm. Actually, let's go back for a second. The Kansas are Kansas All-Stars, so that's 11. Then we have the Stockton Stingrays and the West Coast Dogs, which are 13. We have the Taiwan Home Run, and I'm missing one other team. And who am I missing? I always seem to forget one other team, but I'm missing that 15th team, Doc, if you can remember. But those are the teams right now who are registered for the 2008 World Series, 2008 season. And by all means, if anyone wants to go see the whole kit and caboodle and the teams that are registered, they can go over to nbba.org, and there they will also find all the most up-to-date details regarding this year's World Series.
Excellent. David said something about Comets, too. Okay. So, Ed, tell me how the World Series is organized. So you've got 15 teams who essentially, let's say 15, who start out essentially in all in joint possession of first place. And you've got 4 or 5 days in which to crown a world champion. So what's the process?
The way they start out, Paul, is that the first day is we have what we call a round-robin play, and the top four teams from last year's World Series will be seated in the top of each of these round-robins, and they will play 3 games, and then after that day, the top teams that come out of this, they will be seated in the double elimination championship tournament, and that starts on Wednesday, and they keep playing until you get down to Saturday with the two best teams still in the tournament. And it's but we always seed the tournament to try to encourage the teams to play hard, even though you may not be the top team, because the better you do overall, the higher the seed is, and it seems to make the competition better, and everybody seems to like that situation. We started that a couple of years ago.
Hello, this is Gary Wood from Michigan. Are there any Michigan teams in beat baseball series?
Not as of right now. Our first vice president, though, her name is Jan Trafagan, or Trapagan, and she's from the Detroit or northern part of Detroit area.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to the World Series because I'm not at all sure I understand. I think I understand the double elimination tournament. If I'm getting it, it's very much the same approach that's taken to the College World Series. Is that right, Ed?
Well, the double elimination tournament, Paul and others, you have to lose two games before you're out of the tournament, and so you keep playing as long as you keep winning. And if you lose the first game, then you go over to the loser's bracket, and you can come back and get into the championship game that way. But you lose two games in the championship round to be put out of the tournament.
Excellent. Yeah, that's the same way that the College World Series is played. But that still leaves me not understanding what happens the first day, how the round-robin play works. And also, do you eliminate teams on that first day through the round-robin tournament?
Paul, no. The round-robin is done for two reasons. First of all, that gives every team that comes to the World Series three games there and then two games in the championship, which will mean every team gets a minimum of five games. But the round-robin is set up to seed or to put the best teams in play at the top of the brackets in the double elimination tournament. So that's the reason for the round robin.
Excellent. So essentially the only impact that the round robin has is by determining who gets seeded where and kind of who plays who in the opening round of the double elimination tournament. And the other purpose is of course to be sure that everybody who comes does get a pretty good opportunity to play a fairly large number of games. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did, Paul. And you know, if a team comes from, say, all the way from Taiwan and they only get in a double elimination tournament and play two games and they're out, that really is pretty tough. So the round robin was put into play several years ago, and then the double elimination tournament, so that every team would get at least five games in, so to give them their opportunity to play more and to not have to spend that big money just to come out and play two ball games.
Paul, just something to add to that. Last year and the year before, we started going to a situation of having teams play more games because you're playing, whether you win or lose, will determine where you are seated in the following year. So there are certainly possibilities for teams really to play seven games during the week. And right now, this is the first year we're doing it. Our round robin will start on Tuesday, and then very seriously, teams could play two games on Wednesday, two games on Thursday, and, of course, two games on Friday.
And then on Saturday, there is the championship game, which is between either a team that's gone all the way through and hasn't lost and a team who presumably has one loss by the time they get there. So, sounds fun. And is it like the NCAA tournament where in the double elimination tournament, it can happen that the two teams that are in the championship game will have played each other before that in the tournament?
Yes, that's possible, Paul. And if the team that comes to the championship game has one loss and they happen to beat the team that has no losses the first game, then they have to play a second game to determine the championship.
Something also to add there, Paul, with that is last year in the 2007 World Series, with all the regional tournaments that Kansas All-Stars went to, their record all the way through, including the World Series, was a perfect 18-0.
Oh, my goodness. These Kansas people are dangerous folk. So let me ask a question. I know that in the past, goalball tournaments have been broadcast and Of course, international blind cricket competitions have been broadcast or netcast, so that people who aren't there are going to be able would be able to listen to results. Ed, do you guys have any plans to make any of these games available on ACB radio or somewhere else at this point?
Well, we're working to get the championship game done live if we can. Steve Guerra is working on that with his equipment and knowledge, but last year it was taped and then broadcast later on ACB radio, but we hope to do it live this year.
Another thing I want to also add there, Paul, is the I am working towards bringing that live on ACB radio. Last year we had the podcast, and that also is available from the website of www.mbba.org. On our homepage that someone could listen to. It was about 2 hours and change, 2.5 hours. We ran it live on ACB World. Would be great if we were able to do that again this year. I had the podcast hosted and commentated on by Kevin and Wayne Sibson. Kevin is the pitcher for the Austin Blackhawks, and Wayne is a longtime beat baseball player. With Kevin's play-by-play and Wayne's color commentary, and with my adding my two cents in from here and there, it really turned out to be a great broadcast, and it was fun had by all. I can tell you it probably, since from what historians have told me, since 1983, it probably had to be one of the wettest World Series championship games. We were underneath tents, and everyone had sweatshirts on and plastic bags because everyone was being drenched, but the broadcast went on, and you would have never known by listening to it that it was torrential downpours and gusting winds. We had a great time, and then, again, I hope to have Kevin and Wayne, if they're not already participating in the championship game, to be back with me this year on the broadcast, if not someone else. But we're going to do it live. We have all the equipment in place, and it's just a matter of getting a few other pieces together, and I think we'll be able to do it. It's a it'll be broadcast hopefully live on ACB radio and another radio station, internet radio station, that I do a sports show on. But it's looking forward to that.
Gosh, so are we. Now that we will have a chance to whet our appetite. So let me be sure I have the website correct. It's NBBA for National Beat Baseball Association .org. And if people go over there, they can find out much about how National Beat Baseball works and also get an opportunity to hear that, that scintillating championship game from last year. I'm presuming since they went X and O that Kansas was one of the teams in the championship game. Which was the other?
The on the NBBA website is the championship game as well as a video that was shot 2 years ago in Cleveland in Strongsville, Ohio, in the 2006 World Series, which is called Love at First Beep, which was videoed as well as produced by ESPN.com. So those are the two audio links that you would find on the homepage. And as other things come up, as we're able to do other things, it will be available on a set on the World Series page, say for instance. But it's those are the only two audio links I'm aware of on a website.
Now it's interesting that ESPN has done this on their website, you know, the ESPN.com, as about beat baseball. I'm wondering in the with the weather that you get sometimes when you mentioned it was raining in some of these games. Does that affect the function of the ball, you know, the beeping part, or does that have anything to do with it?
Well, to answer your question, beat baseball has been played many times in rainy weather, and the ball never lasts a long, long time anyway, whether it's dry or wet, but it probably does affect it to some degree, but we go ahead and play anyway unless there's lightning or the rain is blowing so hard that it's hard to do anything. But just general rain, we have played many, many beat baseball games.
And David Smoka let us know that the other team in the World Series last year was the West Coast Dogs from California. So it was the Dogs versus the All-Stars. And I'm presuming, and I know that the All-Stars won, Do any of you remember the score?
Score 17-11. Forgive me. Is that about right? It may have been 17-4. I don't know. It escapes me right now.
Either way, a relatively low-scoring game. So here's the question, and I'll start with Ed, and then we'll go to Steve. Ed, do you have as many people involved in the National Beat Baseball Association as you'd like to have? And if you don't, what are you doing, and what do you think can be done to encourage more people to get involved in the sport?
Well, first of all, no, there is not as many people involved as I would like to see it. I think there are two main reasons why, and one of them is beat baseball is a very expensive game because of the cost of the ball and the travel involved. The other reason is that the youngsters, are not as active as the players and the people were back a number of years ago. Kids nowadays are more sedentary, more play in front of the computer. They don't get out and play and get involved as much as kids used to do. We are trying. We are doing things to publicize. I think if we had the opportunity to do more, we would. And I think that's part of the plan that we have in play now is to try to reach more of the young people and get them interested and excited about being in beat baseball. And to play beat baseball, you don't have to be a star athlete, but you do have to have some skills and some desire.
Tell me, have you tried to get beat baseball played in some of the schools for the blind across the country, and have you been successful at that?
We have tried that in several different places, and some of the schools have done somewhat, and some of them have referred players to the teams that we have, but I don't think any school has actually had an organized team that actually played that much. I don't know why they don't, but they don't seem to want to get involved too deeply into it.
Steve, do you have any ideas or anything that you'd like to add about how we could spread beat baseball?
Overall, it's an entire membership's effort. It's every person going out, impressing upon people about the sport. It's everyone taking pride in the sport and wanting to share with other people. It's the importance of every team knocking down every door and really getting to everyone who is visually impaired or totally blind in the area and introducing them to this. I can't begin to tell you the countless amount of times that I've gone the extra mile to try to seek out an individual who may be totally blind or partially sighted and say, hey, there's a recreational avenue for you to join in and to become, and to not only increase on your social skills or learn how to interact with other people and with people that are in a similar situation, but it also gives you an opportunity to be athletic and, like Doc said, not be sedentary and not sit in front of a TV or sit on a recliner or sit in front of a computer and such like that. And Doc's right in saying that, you know, there has to be more awareness of people out there. I think there are certainly people out there of the 70% of the unemployment that, God, if we had 70% of the people who were unemployed taking part in the MBBA, I think our roles will be about 1,000 people, if not more. The community is relatively small and close-knit, but it's not that small that we couldn't have more than the 300 members that we have now. I think it takes everyone's effort to try to increase the membership no matter what. You know, and teams are growing little by little. But teams lose people and teams gain people. And, you know, it's not only just players, it's volunteers. And without the importance of us going out and trying to find volunteers that can be trained to not only interact with individuals who are either partially sighted or totally blind, but also to reap the benefits of their knowledge of sports to not only make the team better or to contribute to the team in a way that will allow the players to really excel at the sport, it really takes everyone's efforts, both volunteers and players, to increase their membership. Everything's been done word by mouth, but there are campaigns that we're certainly working toward to not only maybe reach out again to the different schools for the blind and out that are out there in the United States, as well as to publishing articles maybe in the national organizations, magazines, and other periodicals, and you know every bit helps. But you know it takes everyone's part. You know it's not just a certain group of people who are going out on a public relations committee to increase the amount of membership and the membership committee to think of brainstorm ideas to make this happen. But it takes everyone's part.
Sounds like we all have some work to do if we want to see Beat Baseball spread. Ed, it occurs to me there's one portion of the game that we haven't talked about so far, and it's a part of baseball that certainly is important, and that is the officiating of the games. Does Beat Baseball have umpires, and how do they work? And I guess the one other question is, we had talked a little bit about foul balls, but I guess the one part that I'm still not quite getting is, can a batter actually strike out by hitting a foul ball, or must he strike out by missing the ball?
The person cannot strike out by fouling out. Foul ball still keeps the batter alive. They have to physically strike out by missing the ball when they're swinging the bat. If the batter, though, takes, because each batter is given four strikes and one pass ball, one take, if they intentionally take a second ball that they already have three strikes on them, that will be counted toward them as a strikeout because they've purposely taken a second pass ball.
Ed, tell us about umpires.
We do have umpires, and they are cited. we have a home plate umpire that does call out the balls and strikes, and he makes the final decision on whether it's a run or whether it's a out. We do have a base umpire at each base to say the word here when the runner touches that base, and we try to have at least one out in the field umpire, called a field umpire, that watches the player, and when the ball is caught cleanly off the ground under control, he says the word caught, and then the home plate umpire decides which happened first and makes the call. So that, yes, we do have umpires. We sometimes don't have all four of them in some of your smaller games, but we do have them at the World Series. And we have several umpires that have been umpiring for a number of years that come to each World Series, and we use them at our home plate umpires, and then we get the volunteers and give them a quick little training program to help them know what to do to help us with the other official part of the game.
Now, I guess the chief competition to Beat Baseball would be goalball or is it?
Well, Paul, there are probably more people playing goalball than there are Beat Baseball, but there are several reasons for that. Number one is goalball is played indoors, and there's only three people on a team. And you have one ball, and it doesn't cost very much to play the game because that ball doesn't wear out like a Beat Baseball does. And a lot of your school, most of your blind schools have goal ball as one of their activities. But goal ball was started by the veterans after World War II to have a sport for the blinded and visually impaired veterans to play. And that was quite a few years before Beat Baseball started. So I would say that it is a competition, but in lots of ways it's not, because one of them is an indoor sport, one of them is an outdoor sport.
It seems to me, certainly judging by what my folks in Miami tell me who have been trying over the past several years to keep a goalball team alive, that anymore it is still a pretty expensive undertaking, because you have to have uniforms, you have to have a coach, you of course have to raise money for travel, and while all of those things are certainly a part of Beat Baseball as well, I think part of the problem that all sports played by people who are blind have is that there is a pretty large infrastructure that has to be supported by the sport, which is actually pretty expensive to do. I wish we could find some other ways of providing financing for some of the approaches that you're currently taking. If my memory serves me right, Ed, and this is directed to you simply because you've been around in beat baseball for longer, my memory says that there were some states that had beat baseball teams that don't anymore. My memory says there used to be a beat baseball team in Oklahoma. Is that correct? And are there some other areas where that used to be hotbeds of beat baseball that aren't anymore?
Paul, you're absolutely right. Oklahoma did have a team for many years, and they no longer have a team that plays in Oklahoma. However, several of their pitcher and two or three of their players play on the West Coast Dogs team now. But there are other areas that do not have beat ball anymore, such as San Antonio, Texas used to have three teams. Dallas-Fort Worth used to have a team. Beaumont, Austin used to have two teams. Houston used to have three. El Paso used to have a team. Wichita Falls used to have a team. We used to have 14 or 15 teams in Texas alone, but now we have three. I don't know. I think age has something to do with that. I think expense of travel and expense of the ball and all that kind of stuff has a lot to do with it. But I think there are probably some other areas that have experienced some of the same thing. There used to be, I think, three or four teams in California. But I think those two things, age and the cost involved, is a big part of it.
Do not forget Chicago, and also in upstate New York, there was a team in the Binghamton area, there was a team in the Ithaca area, there was a team from Long Island. When Boston Renegades first got started, they were two teams. They were the Lowell Lab Retrievers as well as the Boston Renegades. And it's, you have hotbeds. Doc was right. In the San Francisco area, there were a couple teams. But beat baseball has certainly died down because of cost, but also I guess people are afraid to play, not only because it can be dangerous, but I guess people are not willing to do the extra work to go out and play. And once, someone who's never played before goes and plays a sport, they really get into it for the first time, but it's getting them to that field to show them how to play is the difficult part.
Ed, I know you and I have talked about this before, but I'm going to ask you the question anyway. Have you yet had an opportunity to have anything to do with seeing what blind cricket is about? And do you think beat baseball is in danger of being taken over by blind cricket?
I don't think there's any danger being taken over by it, but I have not researched it very much. I have heard a little bit about it, but not enough to really say I know the game or anything. But I would certainly be interested in learning more about it. I think it would be a great opportunity for us all to share with them, with the people who play cricket and NBBA. I think it'd be a great opportunity to have a sharing, to learn from each other, and maybe we can get some tips on how to make the thing grow better or whatever.
One other thing I wanted to mention, Paul, is in Italy, Hungary, and Cuba, they play a different version of baseball for the blind, which does not involve a beat baseball. It does involve a couple of beat bases, but their game is vastly different, and they play it all over the country of Italy, in Hungary, and also in Cuba. And that ball is played where there's no pitcher and catcher. The ball is self-hit by the batter. He automatically hits it to the left side. Each team has five defenders and one sighted person standing at a second base. What will happen then is the batter will hit the ball automatically to the left side. Then the batter will run to a beeping base, which is at first. And then they will have to run to a second base, which is manned by someone who's clapping their hands so the person can get to that base. 2 meters away, there's a second base that the fielders who are situated on the left side of the field who field the ball have to throw to that second base, where a member of their own team is there. That person has to catch that ball before the batter gets to the second base for it to be an out, or if the batter gets to that second base, it's a run. But that's just a little bit on how they play that version of baseball for the blind.
Let me go to Steve first, and then to Ed, for any final comments they might have on Beat Baseball or the future or whatever you'd like to leave with listeners to Tuesday Topics. Steve?
I will tell you that I think personally from my perspective, the organization has a lot to grow. However, we should also be thankful of all those individuals who make the sport possible. Our volunteers of each team, the pitchers and catchers and field spotters and other team volunteers, and those volunteers who are national officials, such as the scorekeepers, base operators, and umpires, who tirelessly give of themselves to make this sport happen and allow us to play in the competitive way that we do. I think also other things I wanted to mention is I do a sports show on a internet radio station. The website is hkcradio.com Thursday night and usually on Saturdays from 10 a.m. until noon. I have a show that we talk about different sports for the disabled, but I have a long history of doing podcasts about Beat Baseball, and if people were interested in that website, that is beatbaseball.org. But I want to say to Paul, thank you for having this and hosting this show and this forum about talking about Beat Baseball, and I hope many people get as much from it as what we can provide. If you want to find a local team in your area or find out if there's a local team, you can go to the website of www.nbba.org or send an email to secretary@nbba.org. Thank you again, Paul, for, again, hosting this.
Ed, final comments?
I also want to thank you for inviting me and Steve in and hosting this show about Beat Baseball. But I would like to take a different turn in my final comments, and that is to say that Beat Baseball is a great sport, but Beat Baseball does a great deal more than just give kids an opportunity. And I say kids because I feel like when I was playing at 36 years old, I was like a kid out there. It gives them an opportunity to expand their knowledge, expand their awareness, expand their mobility, expand their confidence. And these things are extremely important in today's world. And Beat Baseball, I've seen it happen many, many, many times, how it has really changed people's lives. Blind athletes as well as some of our volunteers that play with us in Beat Baseball. Beat Baseball is more than just a game, but it is a fun game for the blind and visually impaired. It's a tremendous spectator sport. The spectators that I have seen in the past come out and see the game. It has even affected their lives greatly a lot. And I sure hope that we can get more people to not only play Beat Baseball, but to come out and see it at our World Series at DeMeyer Park, July the 28th through August the 2nd in Houston, Texas.
Thank you, Ed, and thanks to our lurker, Dave Smoka from Chicago, Illinois, the coach of the Chicago Comets, who are planning to take the World Series of Beat Baseball this summer by storm, and that very much is what ACB, ACB Radio, and Beat Baseball are all about. Play the game. Don't stand on the sidelines.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 2 hours Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.